Welcome to Gallery. I'm Melissa Keeney. It's an honor to have as my only guest today President Emeritus Frederick L. Hovde, who led Purdue into the growthful years following World War II and retired in June of 1971. Dr. Hovde, a marvelous book has just been written about your years at Purdue and your background and how you got here. It's published by the Office of Publications here at Purdue University and written by Robert Topping. And you just now sort of christened it, so to speak, in this gala week, and you had an autograph signing session. It's a beautiful book and a must, I think, for folks who are alums of Purdue University.
Well, thank you very much. I, of course, wouldn't be that full of praise for it. You know, knowing yourself, why, you're not probably as interesting to yourself as you might be to others.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and it's divided into very well. It starts off with just your boyhood and then goes into your Minnesota years and your experiences as a Rhodes Scholar in Oxford, into the career beginnings and what happened in World War II, and on up into Purdue and what all you've done for the university. Let's start off with your boyhood. You were born in Erie, Pennsylvania.
Well, no man can pick where he's born or who his parents are. But I was lucky in my parents. My father was a meteorologist with the U.S. Weather Bureau and was stationed in a good many places in his career. And he happened to be stationed at the Weather Bureau in Erie, Pennsylvania when I was born. So that's how I come to claim Erie, Pennsylvania as my birthplace.
You moved shortly thereafter to...
Oh, Dad moved a number of places. He was in Nashville, Tennessee. He was in St. Paul, Minnesota, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And then when I was about 5 years old, he was moved to Devil's Lake, North Dakota. And he stayed there as in charge of the Weather Bureau in Devil's Lake, North Dakota for all my boyhood and through high school. And then they moved after I finished the University of Minnesota. So they must have lived in Devil's Lake, 16, 17 years.
So he had a cold spot to report from.
That's right. Devil's Lake was a very cold place in the winter. And a number of times each winter you could depend on it being the coldest place in the contiguous 48 states.
But you went to high school there.
Yes, I went to Devil's Lake High School. Devil's Lake was the name given to a large lake, which was in that portion of Dakota. It was the last remnant of an old glacial lake called Lake Souris. And it was a beautiful spot, actually. And when I was a boy, the lake had dried up. The whole East Lake was nothing but a white alkali plain. The West Lake still had water in it, but it was salt water and alkaline water. When the settlers came into that country in about 1880, they settled the town of Devil's Lake, homesteaded all the farms in that region, the farming area, and the lake was right up to the edge of the city where the Great Northern Railroad came through. When I was a boy, the lake was 5 miles away. It had dried up that much.
Is that right?
Swimming was very good when I was a boy because it was salt water. But there were no fish in the lake anymore. Yet when the settlers first came out there, the lake was full of fish. And it was a beautiful lake, and it was a great Indian part of the Sioux Indian country. On the south shore of the lake was Fort Totten, which was one of the army forts built during the Indian Wars in the 19th century, after the Civil War.
So you grew up in a place, would you say, that had a lot of heritage behind it, a lot of...
Well, it was a North Dakota city, one of the largest cities in North Dakota, actually. It was a city of 5,000. And it was in a particularly beautiful part of North Dakota, which is a state of plains, farming land, which extends for miles and miles and miles, and the wind blows all the time. It's wheat country. They raise wheat. And all the farms around Devil's Lake were wheat farms.
And sounds like a beautiful spot.
Well, it was. And the strange thing about it is that the lake has now come back. In recent years, there have been enough rain in North Dakota to replenish the lake, and it's now has fish again in it, and the East Lake has got water in it. In the early days, the lake used to drain out into Stump Lake, and then Stump Lake into the James River, Jim River it was called. The Jim River drained into Red River of the North. Red River of the North drained into Hudson's Bay. The Red River of the North is the river between North Dakota and Minnesota, the boundary line, and flows north. There was a big project to divert water from the Missouri River behind the dam at Garrison near Minot, North Dakota. The plans were to dig a ditch and divert water from the lake behind the dam at Garrison, North Dakota. I think it's called Garrison Lake, isn't it?
That sounds right.
That sounds right. I've forgotten. But they never had to dig that ditch and divert that water from the Missouri into Devil's Lake to rebuild the lake, to re-water the lake, so to speak. It just did it by itself from rainfall through the past 20 years.
Now, your mother always said that you were always interested in education, in learning.
Well, I liked to read. The local library was just across the street from where we lived. The winters were long and cold. And I don't know, I must have read almost every book in the library. But, you know, I mean, I now always like to excel in the classroom. I liked the subject matter. I liked the things I was, well, the things that described this world of ours and the people in the world.
So what were your
favorite?
There
were so many fascinating things to learn. A man can't possibly learn all the things he wants to learn.
What were your favorite subjects, as you recall, in high school?
Well, I was always interested in math and science, and but I had a great interest in all my subjects. I even liked my English.
And sports.
Well, that was another thing. That had nothing to do with the academic side of high school. Yes, I was always interested in sports from the time I was knee-high. You see, our home was in the Federal Observatory building, which was a two-story brick building. And we had a big lawn. We had a lawn that was a block long and a half a block wide. And this was my football field. So I owned the football field, and I was the head of football, and I was the captain and quarterback and coach of my grade school teammates, the team we had, football team we had. So I played football from the time I could hold on to a football.
Was football your favorite sport back in high school?
Well, I think it was the sport I played best. I played basketball and also ran on the track team. Basketball was fun. I never was very good at it, but I always liked football the best of all.
Now, when you went away to school, you went to the University of Minnesota.
Right.
Why did you choose that school?
Well, for several reasons. One, I wanted to study engineering, and in particular chemical engineering. Although I entered civil engineering first, but I soon transferred to chemical engineering. And the University of North Dakota wanted me to come down there to play football. But I decided that I would rather pursue my engineering studies at the University of Minnesota. At that time, going to Minnesota, I didn't think that I could ever make the football team or the basketball team at Minnesota. But that wasn't the most important thing. And then all my family had lots of family in Minneapolis. My grandfathers both came from Minneapolis and lived there. And mother and dad had lots of relatives in Minneapolis.
So you were familiar with the area,
so
too?
So that was one of the Hovde clan's homes, so to speak.
Now, in college, can you relate some of the experiences or some of the things that maybe were turning points in your thinking about what you wanted to do with your life? Did you decide you definitely wanted to be a chemical engineer there?
Yes, I decided I wanted to study chemical engineering. That occurred quite early because as a freshman, first semester, first quarter, I think I was registered as a civil engineer, but I soon transferred to chemical engineering. And I enjoyed that curriculum very much. And
do you recall what you wanted to do with it at that time?
Oh, yes. I wanted to go into industry. I wanted to be a chemical engineer in industry. I didn't have any thoughts about going into education at that time.
And then you went off and became a Rhodes Scholar.
Well, after I went to England, you see, in England, they at Oxford, they didn't have engineering, chemical engineering as such. And I studied physical chemistry at Oxford. And physical chemistry is a logical extension of my interest in chemical engineering, which is physics and chemistry and practice in industry coupled with a dollar sign. You see, all engineering has to be aware of the cost of not only the original cost of the equipment, but the cost of operating it, the cost of producing what you are producing in your company. So engineering is science with a dollar sign attached to it.
Now, what year was this that you spent at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar?
I went to England in the fall of 1929. I graduated from Minnesota in the spring of 29. And the Rhodes Scholars from the United States organized, those who wished to, were organized into a sailing party. And we left New York on the Cunarder, the sister ship of the Lusitania. We went on the Aquitania.
Oh.
There were 25 or so of us. There were 32 Rhodes Scholars a year. But there were about 25 of us in the sailing party. And that was fun because it gave us a chance to get acquainted with our class of Rhodes Scholars, almost all of them. And in the group on board the ship were two other Rhodes Scholars who were all going to the same college at Oxford. Armistead Booth was a Rhodes Scholar from Virginia, and then Malcolm McIntyre was a Rhodes Scholar from Massachusetts. He lived in Boston, rather Newton, Massachusetts at that time, and was a graduate of Yale. Armistead Booth was a graduate of the University of Virginia. They both studied law at Oxford and both became very successful lawyers.
So you maintained some of those friendships you made going over on the ship then through the
years? Oh, yes. Mr. McIntyre and I were in the same college, and we shared our rooms together in the second year and third year. We became great friends. We went on many vacations together on the continent, France and Germany. And enjoyed living together as roommates in college. And then the third year, we had an Englishman who roomed with us. Three of us had digs. They call them digs when you're out and living with landladies in the town of Oxford. We had a third member of our group, an Englishman by the name of William Roots, who was also a law student. His father, Bill Roots came from Jamaica. He was an Englishman. His father the man who looks after the harbor. What's Kingston? Isn't that the harbor in Jamaica? Harbor master. His father was harbor master at Kingston. Bill had gone to English private school. They call it public school, but it's very private in England. He was a student at Brasenose College, where Mac and I were, and we were friends, and three of us roomed together. So we had a very interesting young Englishman who was part of our triad.
Well, students now go abroad quite often to study. This was really a unique experience to see a glimpse of the world at that young age.
Well, yes, of course it was, because it was an opportunity that was one of the most fortunate things that ever happened to me personally. But in 1930, well, the stock market crash occurred the week after we arrived in England. So I spent the entire, well, the first part of the Great Depression, those years in England. And I came back in 1932, which was really the bottom of our depression years. And jobs were scarce, and money was difficult. And you're too young to remember that the banks were all closed in the spring of 1933. And that was a trying and difficult time for everyone. Yet the Depression years were interesting because people were so nice, and they were so nice to each other and so helpful. Everybody was in the mess together, and nobody had any money or work or anything. And yet everybody helped everybody else.
Do you see?
They were politer and nicer in the Depression years than they have been ever since.
They had to pull together, didn't they?
Well, that's just what people do when they're in trouble.
Do you think this country maybe might need something like that? I mean, the economy is not in too good a shape right now.
No, but I don't think we will have a depression like we had in the big depression that I went through as a young man. Too many things were done in the decade of the 30s and so on, in the so-called New Deal. There were a great many laws and developments on the part of the federal government which were intended to prevent the collapse of the stock market and business and economic collapse in general. And I think many of those laws which were opposed by the more conservative people in that time, they were New Deal laws, have turned out to be very, very, very fine laws in retrospect over the years. I remember, for instance, the laws. Remember, the banks failed. A great many banks failed in the Depression. People lost their savings. One of the laws that came along in the 30s, as I remember, was the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC. That guaranteed everybody's deposits up to $10,000. If a bank failed, it was an insurance setup on the part of the federal government. Funny thing about it, in those days, the banks all opposed it. Now they advertise it. They're members of the FDIC. Been one of the great successes.
It's funny how history proves itself through the years, and something that may not seem right at the time, it pans out that way.
Yes, of course. I suppose you can find more illustrations of things that didn't pan out than things that did.
That's true. Back for a moment just to your Oxford experience. Rugby was a big sport of yours.
Well, rugby was the English football. The general populace of England and the continent and the rest of the world play soccer football. That's the what they call association football. And rugby is a game, the English counterpart of our football. Our football grew out of rugby, but we've changed it so much over the years, you wouldn't recognize the two. English rugby has changed very little over the years. And it's a very rough and demanding game. And it's played by, it's more or less an upper class game, that is. It's played by gentlemen, so to speak. And there are rugby clubs in every city of the United Kingdom. They're amateur rugby clubs, and the membership of those clubs who go on playing rugby for their club teams are lawyers and doctors and architects and businessmen who've gone to the universities and so on and played rugby and like to continue it. I was a member of the Harlequin Rugby Club in London, one of the leading rugby clubs in England, and the captain of the Harlequins, when I played for the Harlequins in 1932, was a London architect by the name of Adams. And he was captain of the Harlequins, and was playing first-class rugby at the age of 36. He had been a Cambridge rugby player as a young man. But it offered a chance for the rugby player to join his hometown rugby club and go on playing.
Now, you say rugby and football were not that much different then.
Our football grew out of the rugby game. But we modified ours every year since it started. The first game in this country was between Princeton and Rutgers, way back about 1880. I've forgotten the exact year the first football game was played. But rugby started in England in the middle 1800s, when William Webb Ellis, a student at Rugby School, picked up the soccer ball and ran with it and started a new game they called rugby. That's where it gets its name.
That's really how it evolved.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the interesting things in your book, Dr. Hovde, about the Hovde years was the chant of Oxford rooters. Hovde, Hovde, Hovde. Can you tell us about that game?
Oh, I didn't even hear it. I don't know who said that. I didn't even hear it.
It's in the book.
It may be in the book, but I didn't hear it. Somebody else said it. But I played for the Oxford Varsity against Cambridge. That game is always played at a stadium in London called Twickenham. And it is the game of the year. It's the most important game for both universities. And to be selected for the team to play against Cambridge. See, the team is run by its captain, who's a player, student, and its secretary, and the men who are back who played on the team the year before. And they select the team each year. The men who are seniors who graduate just go, they have to replace them every year with undergraduates. So they have trial games. And the captain and his secretary, it's called the Oxford University Rugby Football Club. The captain and his secretary and the Old Blues, they're called, the men who are all back from the team the year before, watch these trial matches and then pick out the best players from all the colleges of Oxford and invite them to come and play for the varsity in a series of matches it has with club teams all over England. And so you will get a very nice note from the captain of the team. Dear Hovde, will you please play for my team, captain always called it his team, my team against Bristol on Saturday afternoon at 2:30 p.m. at Iffley Road Stadium. That's the name of the stadium in Oxford. So you write back and say, my dear Captain Roberts, I would be delighted to play for your team on Saturday against Bristol, the Bristol Rugby Football Club at Iffley Road Stadium at 2:30 on Saturday afternoon. So all the men that they want to see and try out are invited to play with the varsity in its games. And then there's a group called the Greyhounds with its captain and its officers. The Greyhounds are more or less the second unit. I mean, to be invited to play with the Greyhounds is a great privilege for the young Englishman who likes to play rugby, because that means that he's noticed enough to be in line to be picked for playing for the varsity in some of its trials. And then, finally, I'll never forget this particular happening, but most of us were members of a club in Oxford called Vincent's Club. Most of us, when I say most of the athletes of Oxford were on the various teams. And what the Oxford-Cambridge match is always in the first week in December. And I think ours was on December 7th, something like that, or 8th, forgotten now.
It says December 8th here, 1931.
Well, that's it, December 8th. And about 3 weeks before the varsity match, a letter was posted on the bulletin board of Vincent's Club in Oxford. And it said, sheet of stationery, posted on the board, to the members of the OURFC, Oxford University Rugby Football Club. Gentlemen, Inasmuch as the Cambridge game is only 3 weeks away, I suggest the chaps limit themselves to a modicum of beer per day, say one pint with each meal, and smoke not less than 20 nor more than 40 cigarettes per day. Signed, Bill Roberts, Captain.
The British have such a way of saying
so
things.
So that was our training rules. That's, if you play against Cambridge in any of the matches between the two universities, you get your blue, you see, and that's your, Oxford's a dark blue and the Cambridge is light blue, and that's the right to wear a dark blue blazer with O-U-R-F-C on your pocket. And you wear a dark blue tie, the Cambridge wear a light blue blazer and light blue tie. So you see those blazers and ties occasionally around. Especially if you go to sporting events in England, you'll always run into men who wear their Vincent's Club tie, which is dark blue with crowns on it, or their dark blue tie, which indicates they were blues. And in the minor sports, you get half blues. The half blue is a blazer with white stripes, alternate blue and white stripes.
That's a marvelous story about rugby, though. Yeah. What did you, when you left Oxford, what did you do when you got back to the United States?
I came back in 1932 and I joined the staff of the University of Minnesota. It was the only place where I had the offer of a job.
What did you do on that staff at that time?
Well, they were starting an experimental college at Minnesota. I had a job as an instructor in chemical engineering when I went back that summer. And in August, I got a note from Dr. Malcolm McLean to come and see him at the administration building of the university. And I went in one Saturday morning at 9 o'clock to see this gentleman. And he had been appointed director of the General College, a new experimental college that the university was opening that fall in September. And the whole development of the General College proceeded out of the experience of the university, which essentially admitted students from high school, all the students who graduated from high school, regardless of their academic records. And so there were a great many students who came to the university with very poor academic records out of high school. And their prognosis for their academic success was always very, very low. If they weren't academic successes in high school, they were not likely to be academic successes at the university. The question is, what kind of an education should you give that bottom quarter of the class entering on tests and high school rank? And after long study, the university set up what they call the General College, where the intent was to be a two-year curriculum with an associate in arts degree. College had the right to invite to teach for it all the finest teachers of the university. The college developed survey courses, general education courses in all the major lines of academic endeavor. In English, for instance, we developed an English laboratory. Instead of requiring students to write themes and turn them in, they wrote their themes under guidance in the laboratory with help always available. They didn't have to go and copy Fraternity Brothers themes. They did their own with help in an English laboratory. We developed audiovisual aid department where we showed films and all kinds of slides and things for all the courses. We developed special examinations. We had graduate students in every course making out questions every day following everything that was presented. And then these questions were all validated and put into a examination bank, a bank of questions. We can make duplicate different examinations for every course that would separate and grade all the students, there were comparable examinations, you see, and if you were good enough to do an A on one, you do an A on the other one. They were two different exams, but two and three and four different exams. We gave a lot of attention to the examining system. But then number one was the counseling system. Dr. McLean and I and several other people spent great many hours with every student, counseling them. The problem of many of those students was a simple one. They hitched their wagon to a star, but they didn't have the requisite ability to reach the star. So the problem was to get them to examine themselves as individuals and to get them to understand themselves as individuals and their talent compared with other people, and to find whether they had any special talents. And what you find is that most everyone has something they can do extremely well, if you can find it. And the problem then was to get these students into those things, studying those things, regardless of whether they were at the university. We referred a lot of students to other kinds of institutions. Get them to understand themselves, understand their limitations and their strengths and their weaknesses, and then get them started on what seemed to be the wisest course of their for their own personal development. What you found from counseling these students is that they all had certain abilities and talents that no one else would ever think about or recognize they had. And if you once found that and persuaded the student to develop that, then they were pretty good. And, of course, a lot of the students came into the university with poor academic high school records because of their home backgrounds. They were disadvantaged in some way. They were brought up in different environments, and lots of the environments didn't stimulate the students to learn their own language, for instance. And they were raised in homes where they didn't speak very good English.
Yeah.
So how could you learn good English? One of my students at the General College turned out to be a Nobel Prize winner.
Is that right?
Yeah. Norman Borlaug. Dr. Norman Borlaug is the plant scientist down in Mexico that developed a wheat that is especially suitable for the dry, arid countries of Mexico and Pakistan and countries like that. And for his work, he was given the Nobel Peace Prize some, 10, 15 years ago. He was on campus one time to speak to our plant breeders here. And Dean Andrews, was taking him around. And while he was here, Borlaug said to Andrews, "Before I leave, I'd like to see President Hubdy." Andrews said to him, "Do you know President Hubdy?" He said, "Oh, yes. I was a student of his, Minnesota, and I wouldn't be where I am today if it hadn't been for Fred Hubdy," which is a awfully nice compliment, you know.
That's marvelous. But don't you think that's a problem in education across the board? Isn't that really what you tried to do here at Purdue, is to develop each person's individual abilities?
Well, that's the goal of the counseling system. But once you set your sights on being an engineer, chemical, mechanical, electrical, or an industrial manager, or a home ec, or an ag, or a veterinary medicine, or a pharmacist, the problem is that you've got to have the finest and best training. Anything less is disservice to the person who's entering the profession, disservice to the professions. So my whole attempt was to do what we did here at Purdue extremely well, try to have the finest kind of environment in which to live and to learn. Your environment's very important about learning, as far as your learning is concerned. See, that's one of the great things about Oxford. In the Oxford environment, which goes back, history and tradition go back to the 12th century, hundreds and hundreds of years. Oxford University in my time, 50% of the students held scholarships. Every other chap you saw in college or on the streets of Oxford as a student was a scholar. And so you were with talented individuals. One of the things I noticed right away was their ability and command of the English language. They all spoke better than I did. They all used better words, more descriptive words, more meaningful words to say the things that I stumbled along trying to say. You listen to the young Englishman talk, their command of the language is such that you say to yourself, you dummy you, if they can do it, you can do it. So you become a student of the language on your own. And then you really, once you start something on your own and are interested enough to do it, then you do it well.
That's right. It's self-education is most important, isn't it?
Right.
I remember one thing you did say is that the most important thing a college or university, one of the most important things a college or university can give to an individual is the ability to go on and continue to educate oneself throughout one's life.
Well, that's what you face. If you become a member of a profession, you face a whole lifetime of learning. If you don't, you fall behind. You become outmoded very quickly. The pace of development for all the professions is a fast one.
And that, I think people need to realize that school doesn't stop with a university education, does it?
One of the real purposes and outcomes of the university education is to teach you to do this under your own steam and enjoy it.
And you continue to do that from Oxford on,
I think. Well, you do it to the extent that you're willing to discipline yourself to do it.
After your experience at Minnesota, you went back to England.
No.
You didn't.
Went to the University of Rochester.
Rochester and then back to England is the way it
went. And in 1940, winter of 1940, and England had been fighting. War broke out, what, in late 38? 39. And we were beginning to prepare ourselves for possible involvement in the war. What happened in the war, Great War between Germany and France and England at that time, and then later Russia, was bound to have its effect for a long time future. And our state of preparedness for military effort was woefully bad. In the 30s, we only had an army of, 100,000 troops or something like that, a navy of a few ships. And the Air Corps was a small part of the army then. But, see, the Germans had already shown in the war against England that tank warfare and aerial warfare and so on, submarine warfare, were going to be very, very important. We had no tanks. We had no defense against tanks. We had no dive bombers. We had no defense against the dive bombers. We had no defense against bombers, raiding, and so on. And the military preparations were beginning to get started in 1939, late 39, 40. Of course, Pearl Harbor didn't come until the end of 41, December of 41. But the English came over in the fall of 1940. They sent a scientific team to visit us. The scientific team was Sir Henry Tizard, was its leader, Professor Fowler, and Professor Cockcroft, two very famous British scientists. Tizard, whom I met and knew later when I worked in England, told me that he told the Prime Minister Churchill that he wouldn't come to this country as head of that mission unless the Prime Minister gave him permission to tell everything about their work in England, all the military secrets, all the secret war research that was going on. He had the permission to tell us everything. Well, this was inestimable value to us in this country because we then had the immediate up-to-date information as to, one, what was important in war research, what took high priority, what was needed, how far the British were towards solutions, things that they wanted would need us to do that we could do probably better than they could do. There were a whole host of very valuable things that came out of that visit. Then Dr. Conant of Harvard was chosen to go to England in early 41 to return that visit. Dr. Conant was a member of the National Defense Research Committee, of which Dr. Vannevar Bush was head. Dr. Conant had worked as a scientist in World War I. As a young chemist, he was involved in the poison gas work. War gases work at under the Army Ordnance Department. And way back in World War I, he was a young man. But Conant was a world-famous organic chemist in his own right before he became president of Harvard. But he was a leader, and he had two young men with him, Carol Wilson and myself. So we went to London. I was to set up an office in the embassy in London when they came home, and Wilson was to be my counterpart in Washington. And all the flow of information from all the British laboratories was to go through my office. And then all the flow back from our laboratories was to come through Wilson to me, and I would distribute it to the British. Then I also had charge of all the visits our scientists made to the British laboratories during those, the year 1941, and in 1942 after we came in the war, after Pearl Harbor. So that's how I happened to go to England.
It sounds like a really tremendously stressful job in terms of trying to clear
all
that.
Well, you know, it was 18 hours a day, and scientific work encompassed every phase of warfare, both offensive and defensive. So I think I probably knew more military secrets than any other man alive, almost, at
my
that
goodness.
Time.
Was it terribly frightening to see things unfold?
Well, war is not very pleasant to contemplate in any of its combat phases, or for that matter, any other time.
I guess what I mean
you
is...
You find your only justification is in the nature of the enemy you're fighting. And no one wanted to see Hitler take over.
I guess what I mean...
Or the Japanese.
Yeah. From your perspective, knowing all these military secrets, knowing what maybe would have to be used and ultimately what we did have to do, that must be stressful to have to... You know, have all
well,
that inside your head.
Well, the problem of developing, say, the atomic bomb, that was a stressful thing for all the physicists engaged in it. They knew they were creating a terrible Frankenstein. They knew that if successful, they would create a terrible weapon, which they did. But you see, the weapon itself, when it was only used twice, Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and a couple of 100,000 Japanese were killed. But you measure that against, that ended the war. You measure that against the 10 million Americans in the 10th Army being prepared to invade Japan. And you saved perhaps a million American lives.
Mm-hmm.
We sacrificed innocent Japanese people, but the war came to immediate end. And in my judgment, the atomic bomb has kept the world essentially at peace, the big powers at peace anyway. There have always been minor warfare, guerrilla warfare going on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had the Vietnam War and the Korean War, and there have been warfare all over the world ever since the close of World War II. But no one has ever triggered the big war. In that sense, I think the atomic bomb ought to have the Nobel Peace Prize.
Now, after your service there in England, in this office, you came back to the States, and did you go back to Rochester at that time, or Minnesota, or you?
No,
you came,
I came back
directly?
And I worked in Washington.
In Washington, okay.
I worked 18 months in England and then was replaced. My successor was a chap named Archambault. But I came back and worked in Washington office for Dr. Conant as his executive assistant for a year. That was 1942-43. Then I was made chairman of the Committee for the Development of Our Rocket Weapons. And I directed the development of the Rocket Weapons Ordnance Research Group for the remainder of the war. And our rocket weapons were all for the Army, Navy, and Air Force, and were all artillery-type rockets. We never tried to develop the long-range rockets like the V-2. V-2 was a useless weapon because it could only carry 3,000 pounds of TNT in its warhead, and it cost more than it could destroy. It was an economic costly weapon. It was a freight weapon, almost, as the Germans used it. But we decided not to develop one because we were committed to the bombing of Germany by the B-29s, which in the latter 2 years of the war were bombing in Germany even worse than England was bombed by the Germans. The cities in Germany were being methodically destroyed by our bombing. But after the war, then, the big rockets became the basis for the intercontinental ballistic missiles. But they became important because they carry atomic bomb warheads. When they learned how to make atomic bombs in weight less than 3,000 pounds, then the big rocket became a very important weapon. Mm-hmm. And I finished up my war work in December, transferred my laboratories and people and projects and so on to the Army and the Navy and the Air Force, and then came out to Purdue in January, 1946.
And you replaced Edward C. Elliott.
No. Edward Elliott retired the year before.
The year before, okay.
And Andre Potter was acting president.
That's right. I recall now. Yeah. There were a couple of... I remember there was an argument as to whether you were the 10th or 7th president because...
it depends on whether you count the acting president as presidents or not.
Right.
Because Henry Marshall was acting president before, between Stone and Elliott. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember whether there were any other acting presidents in the history of Purdue or not. But
you came
Andre
out.
Potter was acting president.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the first things?
From June until January, see, the last 6 months of 1945.
I see.
I came in January of 1946. So Potter was acting president for 6 months.
When you came out to Purdue, it was at the end of a war. It was at a time of trying to rebuild this country.
Well, nothing really had been done for 5 years. Mm-hmm. There was no building at the university, not much in the line of repairs. You couldn't get anything. Equipment was difficult to get. Building materials difficult to get. And that extended on after the war. And right after the war, 12 million GIs were mustered out of the armed forces, and a great many of them wanted to come and finish their education. So we went right up to 15,000 students very quickly with the old 1941 university. And we had to build all kinds of temporary buildings. We built temporary buildings all over the place. There's still some left. You see them over there on Old Stewart Field across from the Lambert Fieldhouse. And there's one over by Electrical Engineering still.
That's right.
But there used to be an awful lot of them around here in 1946, 47, 48, 49. And one time I told my wife, we were driving around, I said, I hope it comes a time when I can build a permanent building. And we've built plenty of permanent buildings, too.
So those were your immediate concerns, was the enrollment in building the buildings to house the
people? Well, I mean, your concern was more than that. You had all this enrollment, you had the GIs, and you had, for the first time, you had the married students. You had to provide for them. So they posed a whole new problem for the university. What do you do with all the married students and their wives? And then you had problems of recruiting faculty. You had facilities, equipment problems, library problems. You had all the problems in the book. And they were all magnified because every other university had the same problem, and they were all searching for the same thing. Great competition for faculty people. You never could find enough mathematicians or physicists or engineers to do the teaching job that you wanted done. And you had to do all kinds of makeshift things to get through. But fortunately, education is a self-process, you see. If you want to educate yourself, you can. It's independent of teachers, actually. You're lucky if you have good teachers. They make it more interesting, but you don't need to have good teachers if you want to learn. In fact, you can learn without any teacher at all. if you want to.
That's right, you can. Mm-hmm. What do you see as some of the more important things that you did in your tenure here at Purdue in terms of getting things rebuilt, of really building this into a major, major university, which you have done?
Well, you set your sight to do everything do everything with excellence. You make excellent buildings, you equip them with the finest equipment, you try to get the finest staff, you try to have the highest standards, you try to do everything. Everything that man does is known to other men. And some people do things better than others. And what you try to do is you simply try to make your institution, its people, and everything that you have to work with to perform the teaching function, you try to maximize its quality and its efficiency and all the rest of it. I mean, there's nothing magic about it. You just got to organize to get everybody to do it.
But it takes, I think, a special kind of person to be able to organize all of that. Just like you say, everybody finds their own talents, you found yours. And you have been called by many, many people, as I'm looking at one quote here, as university presidents go, he was easily the best in Big Ten at the time he served.
Hmm. Well, is that the quote from Mr. Cina?
Yes, Dr. it is.
Well, Dr. Cina was one of my vice presidents. He was academic vice president. He did a lot of jobs for the university. He was a very, very fine man.
He's now with General Motors.
He's vice president in charge of research for General Motors. He left us to take that job. University, great loss to Purdue to have him go.
I've had a lot of great people come through here as teachers and as leaders.
Oh, yeah, sure. Every university has. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us some maybe interesting, funny stories that happened in those early years as you came on board and started leading Purdue to what it became over the next 25?
I think those who knew my wife, she should be here to tell the funny stories of the things that happened, because she could tell them. And a great many funny things happened to her. And I wish I could remember them and tell them, but I can't. Many of our friends have heard her tell some of those stories.
And I recall from the book so many humorous things she had to say.
Well, of course, she looked at the university and its people through different eyes than I did. She had a humorous bone in her body that was a delightful one for all her friends who knew her. But
the good balance, I bet, in hard times.
Oh yeah, she was great. She was great fun. Everybody liked her. She was a remarkable woman. She was one of those rare women that was liked not only by women but also by men. You know, some women are liked by women and not by men, and some women are liked by men and not by women. But she was liked by both women and men. She was a remarkable, wonderful lady.
You served at Purdue University as president, Dr. Hovde, for one quarter of the life of the university. And for a very building, one quarter.
That's right, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Purdue was fortunate. It's in the 20th century, beginning in 1900, Stone was the first 22 years. President Stone, he was trained as a chemist. He was followed by President Eliot, who was an educational administrator, but Eliot's training at the University of Wisconsin, I think, was in chemistry. Got out of that very soon and was in schoolwork all his life. And then I came. I was trained in chemical engineering and physical chemistry. So the 70 years that the three of us served, 71 years, I guess, encompassed more than two-thirds of the life of the university. Mm-hmm. And Purdue's presidents have been in office for a long time.
good to have
others
that.
Will have to tell you why, not me.
Let's talk a bit about today, students today versus maybe perhaps when you came into office back in 1946.
Well, when I came into office, we had a special student body, half GIs and half ordinary people. The GIs are very interesting, you see. They'd fought the war. And I always said that a young man who was a lieutenant in the U.S. Army and had a platoon or a squad or a company of East Tennessee hillbillies under his command, he had to grow up pretty fast or he didn't last very long. And men who were in the Navy and men who were in the Air Force and so on had responsibilities and training that made men out of them in a hurry. And when they came to the university, they approached it. Many of them were married, and they approached it with an adult point of view. They were past their childhood, so to speak.
They were really serious about getting an
education. They were serious about getting an education and finishing and getting to work. They had families and wives to support and so on. And they had a sense of responsibility, which had been heightened by their experience as officers. Well, more than half the GIs in who were here in 47, 48, and 49, more than half of them were officers, you see, during the war.
And then slowly, as those folks graduated...
Well, they all graduated pretty much. They were all pretty much gone by 1951 or two. Mm-hmm. And they were replaced by the regular students coming out of high school. You see, we went from 15,000 students down to about 11,000 students in 1951 or so. Then we started to grow. Then we grew about 1,000 students every year from then on until I retired in 1971.
Dr. Frederick Hovde, it has been an absolute pleasure to talk with you today, and I can't thank you enough for coming down and sharing all of your experiences here at Purdue and on your life, really. We are honored, and I hope you'll autograph this book for me, The Hovde Years, which was written by Robert Topping from Purdue University here. It's a beautiful book, and as I say, a real must for any alum of Purdue University. Thanks so much, Dr. Hovde.
Well, thank you, Ms. Keeney. I enjoyed talking to you. Bob Topping did an excellent job on the book. He worked long and hard, and he is to be commended for his part in putting that volume together. Whether or not it's interesting to others, I don't know. My life was my own, and I enjoyed it. I had a lot of interesting things to do and worked with a lot of interesting people and was a lucky man. I always said I had a lucky star.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
You're very welcome.
President Emeritus Frederick L. Hovde. His biography, The Hovde Years, which was written by Robert Topping and published by the Purdue University Press, is available in most area bookstores. A special thanks to Verna Emery, Associate Director of the Office of Publications at Purdue University. That's it for Gallery this week. Thank you for joining me. I'm Melissa Keeney. Tune in again next week at this time as we share the fascinating world of people and events here on Gallery.